This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf, Stan Colander. Stan is a partner at Corvus Communications and is a budget expert and a keen watcher of all things financial, particularly with regard to the Hill. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
Hey, well, Stan, I'm looking forward to this conversation. We can talk a little bit about, I guess, the number one topic other than the NFL players' strike being settled or lockout, whatever you want to call it, and that's the debt ceiling. As a threshold question, just start, what is the debt ceiling?
Well, the government, like anybody who's got a credit card, has a credit limit. It's set by Congress. It's been set by Congress since 1917 when they passed the Liberty Bond Act. 1917 is a should tell everybody why they did it. There was World War I at the time, and the Treasury needed to borrow money, so Congress said, all right, you can borrow up to this amount and no more without, if you need more, you got to come back to us and get permission. The debt has been raised many times. Debt limit has been raised many times since then, with increasing amounts of political problems in making it happen. And it's now reached the point where some in Congress are saying, I'm not going to vote to increase the debt ceiling at all, even though it helps pay for pass bills. And not only that, I'm not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling. Others are saying unless it includes significant deficit reduction. So it's a mess. This should be something that's relatively routine. Some people don't even think it's needed, but legally, it seems to be.
Yeah. Well, you just alluded to a few things there, and I guess we take a step back. And to me, this is like Groundhog Day, and it keeps happening over and again. Whether it's the continuing resolution, I mean, this year seems I've never seen anything quite like it. And then the battle with regard to the budget and whether or not there's going to be a government shutdown. And I know government contractors are starting to become very concerned about this and the debt ceiling, what it means to them. So how did we get to this point that we're here at the end of July, beginning of August, talking about the debt ceiling, where it's going to be raised or not, and whether or not the government's going to have to start prioritizing who gets paid?
Well, there are several ways to answer that question, but right after the election in 2010, the 87 freshmen or first-term members of the House, most of whom are Tea Party supporters or sympathizers, basically said, we're not going to vote for an increase in the debt ceiling unless we get the following things. And they made some extreme demands, including $4 trillion or so in spending cuts, not deficit reductions, but just spending cuts over 10 years. They also wanted health care reform eliminated. They wanted Dodd-Frank change. And they basically said, we're going to deny our votes to you. We're not automatically going to increase the debt ceiling just because in the past it's been increased. So when we actually reached the debt ceiling in May, and the Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, said to Congress, we've got to raise the debt ceiling. We're going to run out of money at some point. Congress basically said, no, this is what we want in return. And that's what they've been arguing about ever since. It is, I think, a little infantile. It is frustrating to me as a taxpayer that, something that should be relatively routine has turned into, such a nightmare. And the nightmare is some of the things you just mentioned, that is contractors, the government contractors, should be worried about not getting paid if next week on August 2nd the government has used all the gimmicks it can use and has no, only has a limited amount of cash left at that point. My personal opinion, I don't have any facts or no one's called to tell me this is going to be the case, but my personal opinion is that the first people who aren't going to get paid are contractors. They will get paid when the government has cash, but not before. So if I were a contractor, small business or otherwise, I'd be worried about cash flow. I'd be worried about new projects being started or not started in this case. It's going to get pretty ugly if we get to this point.
Well, I think your instinct about that is correct. That it's politically, that's the low hanging fruit in terms of who am I going to pick to pay? Well, we'll wait on the contractors, and take care of other priorities first. Well, you know, it sounds to me like what we've got here is negotiations between parties and then negotiations within parties. Is there just a no-win situation here for, you know, Speaker Boehner? Or?
Yeah, Speaker Boehner's in a very, very difficult position. If you remember the vote on the continuing resolution, that's the bill that funded the government through all of through the rest of 2011. I think it passed in April. 59 Republicans, almost all of whom were Tea Party supporters, didn't vote for it. The common assumption, the common wisdom, something I've been saying for, you know, since that vote occurred, is that we can assume that at least 59 votes, therefore, are not going to be available for the debt ceiling. That is, no matter what it includes, no matter what, even if the Tea Party got everything it wanted and more, they simply wouldn't vote for an increase in the debt ceiling. In fact, Michelle Bachmann, one of the Tea Party leaders, a House member from Minnesota, presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann, has said she will not vote for the debt ceiling, period, end of statement, full stop. I'm actually making that number not 59, but closer to 80, as I read the political tea leaves. So 80 out of 240 Republicans have said, or in my estimation, will not vote for an increase in the debt ceiling. That's a problem, because if you take 80 from the 240, that means you've got 160 Republicans
right,
who would vote for a debt ceiling. The problem is you need 218, 217 members to get anything passed. So you've got to do this with some Democrats. So Boehner's problem is, A, he may not have a majority support in his own caucus to vote for any kind of increase in the debt ceiling. But so what does he do? Does he bring it to the House floor anyway, knowing that his own party opposes it, and then it passes with Democratic support, and his own people are really angry with him? So that's his – it's a very, very delicate balance, and I think that's why you've seen Boehner seem a little schizophrenic in recent days.
Does that – I mean, if that – the scenario you just described, does that threaten his position?
Well, that it almost certainly will in two ways, or would. Number one, if he brings a bill to the House floor that isn't supported by a majority of the Republican caucus, there will be some calls for his ouster as Speaker. There's no doubt about it. There are some who have already started to do that, as a matter of fact. Number two, he may get a primary. That is, he may have someone challenge him in his seat from the Tea Party back in Ohio. So it's going to get pretty dicey for him unless he somehow is able to thread the needle here. Harry Reid doesn't face a similar problem, neither does Mitch McConnell in the Senate. But John Boehner is on a very, very short leash.
So you don't sound too optimistic there,
well,
Stan.
No. In fact, I'll tell you straight out. I've been saying since late February that this was going to come down to the last minute, and that I wasn't convinced that there was going to be a deal. And now I know everybody else you talked to has said, those on Wall Street and others have been saying, oh, there's going to be a deal because there's always a deal. Well, this year is different. I'll tell you a quick story. February 28th, I was invited to be and did speak, was rather, the first speaker at the first meeting of the House Tea Party Caucus, and I was speaking about the debt ceiling. What I was told at that meeting, right after me came the Tea Party state chairs from Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Florida. What I was told by the state chairs was, one, no one should vote. It was their feeling that no one should vote for an increase in the debt ceiling, period, end of the statement, the exact same position Michelle Bachmann has taken. Number two, they didn't trust John Boehner or Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader. That's come to pass. Number three, they thought that the biggest thing the Republicans did wrong in 1995 and 96, when it was Newt Gingrich debating Bill Clinton over government shutdown and a debt ceiling, the biggest thing they did, the biggest mistake they made was that they capitulated too early. They gave in to Clinton too early, and they left something on the table. They could have gotten a better deal if they had just waited. All of that told me that, one, Boehner was in trouble, that, two, the debt ceiling was going to be a lot harder than it should have been, and, three, that if there was a deal, it was going to happen on August 1st or whatever the day before was going to be, before we reached the drop-dead date the Treasury set, simply because coming up with a deal any earlier would have made it impossible. It would have really created some problems within the Tea Party. And I am actually very sad to say that all of those things have come to pass. I wish I had been wrong about this, but I'm going to say immodestly, sheepishly, and sadly say that all of the things the Tea Party said back in February 28 have come true.
Wow. Well, that's Stan. That's sobering here, and we're rapidly approaching August 1st. You know, and And I'm just, when we come back, we're going to have to take a break right here. But when we come back, you know, I'd like to get your thoughts about, you know, if there was a deal, what it would look like. And also just get your thoughts of what you think an approach to solving this problem, you know, the debt problem or how that's going to work, what that would look like. But right now we do have to take a break. When we return, we'll be talking more with Stan Collender. He's a partner at Corvus Communications, and we're talking about the debt ceiling. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Every day, men and women across America try to make the transition from wearing the uniform of our armed services to wearing the varied attire of the private sector or civil service workforce. The Coalition for Government Procurement tries to make that transition easier through its Wounded Veteran Training Program Fund, bringing employers and nonprofit organizations together with one united goal, putting veterans to work. There is no nobler task. Each year, the Coalition presents a golf tournament to bring employers together with organizations dedicated to placing vets in the workforce through cooperative efforts. This year, the Coalition's tournament is August 31st at Whiskey Creek Golf Course. Please consider joining the Coalition, its membership, and others for a fun day of golf, all for a great cause. For more information on playing or sponsoring this worthwhile event, visit thecgp.org or call Roger Waldron at 202-331-0975. That's August 31st at Whiskey Creek Golf Course. See you there.
Here's Gus Hunt, Chief Technology Officer, CIA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Emerging Technologies, sponsored by Informatica.
It's an environment that has radically shifted how we deliver capabilities from as a reactive world to a proactive world, where we can truly be agile, responsive, and actually, as a government, deliver what has emerged in the outside world as what we call frictionless IT.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Government leaders have one thing in common. They know data is their biggest asset, but that asset is growing exponentially. Data is expected to grow by as much as 44 times over the next year to a staggering 35.2 zettabytes. Welcome to the era of big data. How will your agency effectively process the volume of data to support missions, serve citizens, and provide the right information to the right individuals? Informatica helps government agencies to move, take in, and manage their data, regardless of how much, what kind, or where it is. Visit Informatica.com.
Profile America, Tuesday, July 26th. On this date, 19 years ago, the Americans with Disabilities Act became effective. Signed into law 2 years earlier, the goal was to guarantee equal opportunity for people with disabilities in public and commercial facilities. This included employment, transportation, and services at all levels of government. There are 36 million people who have at least one disability, about 12% of the total U.S. population. Those with vision difficulties number 6.5 million, while 19.4 million have problems walking or climbing stairs. Another 13.5 million have difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
Randy Vickers has resigned as head of the U.S. Computer Emergency Readiness Team. That's the U.S. agency that helps respond to cyber attacks. According to Reuters, an email announced the resignation, but there was no reason given for why. Vickers' resignation follows several high-profile hacker attacks against the Pentagon and public websites of the CIA and the U.S. Senate. Deputy Director Lee Rock will serve as acting director. I'm J.J. Green.
We have a capsized boat, 2 people in the water.
Every day, EADS North America builds and supports helicopters for the Coast Guard, Army, National Guard, Navy, and Customs and Border Protection.
Rescue swimmer is in the water.
EADS delivers helicopters that save lives every day, including those bright orange Coast Guard helicopters you see patrolling our nation's capital.
We got them. We're heading back.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Your new Cocker Spaniel is waiting to meet you, and you don't have to travel very far. This weekend and almost every weekend, Oldies But Goodies Cocker Spaniel Rescue holds at least one adoption show in the greater D.C. area. Find out where we'll be this weekend by checking out CockerSpanielRescue.com. Stop by to meet the many homeless Cockers of all ages who are looking for their new home. These dogs have already been spayed or neutered and have all their shots. For more information on adoption, fostering, or volunteering, visit CockerSpanielRescue.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
My family struggled, and it was assumed that while I would go to college, I would have to pay for it myself.
Charlie wasn't sure how to get the money she needed for college. Then she found out about federal student aid and the FAFSA.
I don't think I quite realized what a huge deal actually graduating was. Federal student aid definitely made that happen.
Need help planning and paying for college? Find out more at college.gov.
My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Stan Collender, a partner at Corvus Communications, and we've been talking about the debt ceiling. You know, I'd rather be talking about football coming back, but not today.
Well, or can we add the Washington Castles that just went 16-0 in world team tennis and won the championship? Big deal, huh?
Hey, that's great. Well, now I've lost my train of thought, Stan. That was very good. You laid out a really, I guess, sobering picture, before our break about what would happen or not happen and going right up to August 1st to get a deal, if a deal can get done. What happens if it doesn't happen?
Well, first thing is, and I'm going to say this as directly as I can, nobody really knows because we've never been in this situation before. You've got some people, including some of the biggest names in the finance world, including the Fed chairman and others, saying it will be economic Armageddon, catastrophe, disaster, any adjective you'd like to use here. There are others who say, and they are particularly Tea Party folks, who say, oh, this is all overblown, nothing's going to happen, the markets aren't going to care very much. So we really don't know. But what we really don't know, putting the economics aside, is the mechanics of this. That is, what happens if the Treasury Secretary wakes up on August 3rd at 12:01 because he can't sleep, and he realizes the government doesn't have enough cash to meet all its bills that day? And the answer is, we don't know. Again, when we had a government shutdown, actually two of them, 95 and 96, they have a little bit of a manual. We have some experience here. But for this type of situation where the government has a responsibility, it actually is under legal obligation to incur certain bills but then may not have the cash for it, we can only guess what they might do. Now, on the one hand, the Treasury says it can't prioritize bills. Well, we know that's not exactly correct. The Fed will, in fact, pay whatever bills are presented in the order in which they're presented, but what happens if the Treasury simply instructs government agencies to not process checks for contractors? Well, if you haven't processed the checks and the payments aren't, or the electronic transfers aren't made, then there's nothing to prioritize. So in that sense, they can determine which things will get paid and which won't. It could also be that they simply decide not to prioritize anything and then leave it to you to get your check to the bank as quickly as possible. There is a third outcome here. It's the one that a lot of people don't want to think about, but it's becoming increasingly apparent that Treasury may have what I'm going to call extraordinary, almost embarrassingly extraordinary or just embarrassing options. For example, it could have the equivalent of a bake sale to raise cash for the government. I'm being serious. It could sell assets of some kind, assuming it has a legal obligation to do that. So whether there's a market for an aircraft carrier, or for a national park, or that they could actually sell those things or lease those things. We're not sure, but they could try. The most recent variation I've heard of that is, what would happen if the Mint created a $1 trillion coin, a platinum bullion coin, and sold it to the Federal Reserve? And therefore got $1 trillion in the bank, and essentially the equivalent of printing money.
Right.
And then finally is the one a lot of people say, a lot of people think the president should consider and others don't. That is, what if the president simply gets up and says, you know what, I'm not going to let anybody destroy the economy. It's my responsibility as president to prevent that. Therefore, I'm simply ordering the Treasury Secretary to continue borrowing money in the absence of a specific congressional authorization. And I'm doing so under the permission that I see in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which says, Section 4 of which says, the validity of the U.S. debt shall not be questioned.
Okay, well, if that happens, what happens, in the House, I guess, or what?
Well, all right, first of all, you assume that somebody would try to challenge this in court.
Yeah.
Right? Now, it's not at all the lawyers and legal scholars that I've talked to say it's not at all clear that that anybody would have standing to sue the president or the Treasury Secretary in this case. But the most likely outcome, I think, would be an impeachment proceeding that would start almost immediately against the Treasury Secretary and the President of the United States.
Right.
It would be ugly for quite some time.
Well, now you really got me depressed, Sam.
Well, I can send something over to make you feel better.
I'll go home and have a debt ceiling cocktail, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Look, there is nothing about this that's good. Let's be honest about this. Number one, no American likes to see their government performing, or in this case, not performing this way. Number two, nobody should like or think that it's a good idea to play chicken with the U.S. economy and the financial system or the U.S.'s credit rating. I mean, this is something that could increase the government's cost in the budget for years to come.
Right.
I mean, there's just nothing good about this. And do you want to argue about the deficit? Great. But don't hold the debt ceiling hostage to do it.
Right. I mean, and as you mentioned in the past, this has been, sort of part of, I guess the critics would say that's part of the problem. But it seems to me, in order to maintain the government functioning in the past, this was a sort of bipartisan, maybe reluctantly, but a bipartisan, okay, let's raise the debt ceiling kind of.
Well, and I get the ultimate irony, or the thing that gets me most furious, me personally, is that a lot of the people who were demanding that the debt ceiling not be raised, this is Republicans and Democrats, but primarily Republicans, a lot of those who were saying the debt ceiling must not be raised are the same ones who voted for the tax cuts and the spending increases that requires the government to borrow.
Right. That's a great point.
This is the equivalent of going in, having a wonderful meal at an expensive restaurant, using your credit card, and then refusing to pay the bill when it comes in.
That's a great point. I guess it's not, owning up to what you've already done, right?
Right. And you look, if you're a first-term member of Congress, you can say, I didn't vote for these things. I wasn't there. It's not my fault, and I don't have to pay for it. Well, one of the things I would say to these members, and I have, is you swore an oath to protect and to implement the laws of the United States faithfully. So simply saying you weren't there before when they were enacted doesn't get you off the hook.
Yeah, it seems to me, and I guess the thing, when I sit here and watch what goes on, and I'm driving to work, or I'm listening to the radio and hearing what's going on, it's like, it seems to me there's a deal to be done here.
At this point, it's a political problem. I mean, and it's actually not at this point, since the beginning. Let me just give you the latest example of that. Earlier today, John Boehner, Speaker of the House, introduced yet another plan to deal with the deficit, deal with the debt ceiling and the deficit. He didn't call it a plan to reduce the deficit or to reduce government borrowing or to make the government fiscally responsible. He called it a plan to hold President Obama responsible. All right, that's about as much political spin as you can get, and it tells you everything you need to know about what's going on here. Both plans are designed to appeal to particular constituencies and not to get the job done, and that's what's most infuriating about this.
Yeah, I guess. So, real quickly, and I think I may have asked you this question before when you're on the show, back when we were going through the previous scenario on this. But what would you see as a, how would you solve this? If you were you know, president or king for a day, let's say, if we had a king, and you were going to solve this problem, how would you do it? What would you recommend?
Okay, as we're talking here today, it would be very simple. Number one, I just get the debt ceiling passed and get it the hell out of the way. All right, I do not want to in any way, shape, or form put the government's full faith and credit or credit rating or anything else, you know, at stake. The repercussions are the potential repercussions are too bad. And you know what? Even if I'm wrong, I don't want to take the chance that I'm wrong. That's number one. Number two, I am personally a deficit hawk, and I'm known that way. So everything else they're agreeing to, put together in a different package, and let's talk about it, debate it, do whatever. If the votes aren't there to get it done, then let the voters decide at the next election. But that package cannot be all spending cuts. What I see from all the polls is that there is no support for cutting anything other than foreign aid. So if there's no support, then you know that you'll only be able to make limited reductions in a variety of programs across the board and have to have a revenue component. And I'm willing to pay additional revenues if it means the deficit goes down or is eliminated. What I'm not willing to do is decimate the country and the economy through spending cuts alone.
Well, it makes
but
sense.
But then again, I'm not running for re-election.
Right, you're not in the middle of, you're not running for re-election and you're not in the middle of, you know, the politics of the situation.
But, exactly.
Okay. Well, you know, Stan, you know, always thought provoking, always interesting stuff. And it's always about these great, pleasant subjects. But it's great to have you on the show. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Let's get back together when the NFL season starts.
Okay. We'll do that. And my guest today on the show has been Stan Collender. Stan is a partner at Corvus Communication. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Every day, men and women across America try to make the transition from wearing the uniform of our armed services to wearing the varied attire of the private sector or civil service workforce. The Coalition for Government Procurement tries to make that transition easier through its Wounded Veteran Training Program Fund, bringing employers and nonprofit organizations together with one united goal, putting veterans to work. There is no nobler task. Each year, the Coalition presents a golf tournament to bring employers together with organizations dedicated to placing vets in the workforce through cooperative efforts. This year, the Coalition's tournament is August 31st at Whiskey Creek Golf Course. Please consider joining the Coalition, its membership, and others for a fun day of golf, all for a great cause. For more information on playing or sponsoring this worthwhile event, visit thecgp.org or call Roger Waldron at 202-331-0975. That's August 31st at Whiskey Creek Golf Course. See you there.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
Vacation time is just around the corner. Ready to go? Since 1967, Ackerman Security has been keeping families like yours safe and secure. For just $18.95 a month, you can trust in the protection of Ackerman's nationally certified monitoring center. Ackerman offers the latest technology like cell phone control, wireless monitoring, and remote video to your web-enabled phone, iPad, or laptop. Federal government employees get an added bonus. 4 months of monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070 or AckermanSecurity.com.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments. Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
Even my wife really doesn't understand what I do. She calls it cyber chess. Actually, that's close. As a cyber specialist, I help clients understand the critical moves they need to make before an attack occurs. It's more than just data security. It's the full cyber lifecycle.
In a certain context, I'm like my brother. He's preventing crime patrolling the streets. I spend my day online ensuring our clients' data and information systems are secure. It's what I do. I'm good at it.
For a cyber career that's something truly extraordinary, look no further than the strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton. As a global leader in cybersecurity, Booz Allen offers competitive salaries and benefits, ongoing training, and the opportunity to work with recognized cyber thought leaders at a company committed to helping you get the most out of work and life. That's why Fortune named them one of America's 100 best companies to work for again.
That's why I chose Booz Allen.
That's why I chose Booz Allen. For a cyber career that's something truly extraordinary, visit BoozAllen.com/FED. Booz Allen is an equal opportunity employer.
Look around you. One in four kids in the U.S. faces hunger. It's not always easy to see the signs, but in this land of plenty, there are kids who don't know where they'll get their next meal. Join Share Our Strength and take the pledge to end childhood hunger here in America by 2015. Learn how at NoKidHungry.org. Their next meal could come from you.
My name is Abe Lincoln, and I've been thinking about this cool place that you can go. It's a website that I speak of called USA.gov. It's government information online, and that's mighty fine. USA.gov. Got questions on your log cabin? Housing answers, yeah, they have them. USA.gov is your official source. Get Social Security info, whatever that is. ID theft prevention tips, because that's your biz. Even change my address, and I don't mean the Gettysburg. Find government auctions, jobs, apply for student aid. Hey, I wouldn't lie, I'm Honest Abe. It's government made easy for the people. Take it from the dude in the stovepipe hat. USA.gov is where it's at. So don't wait 70 years to check it out. And that, my fellow Americans, is what I'm talking about.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest for this segment is Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge who specializes in government contracts. And Jason, welcome to the show. Great to have you on again.
Oh, good to be back, Roger. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I wish it was on you never know. Whenever a lawyer gets on the show, it's never usually good news, right? But here we are again, talking deja vu all over again, talking about government, what it means for government contractors because of the fiscal challenges our government is facing. Back, you know, in the April timeframe, it was the government shutdown, what was going on there. Now we have the debt ceiling situation and how that's going to be resolved or not resolved. And just big picture, how is this sort of, from your perspective, is it the same? Is it different than the debt ceiling situation as far as government contractors go?
I think it is a bit different. You know, back when we were confronting the possibility of a shutdown, the big question our clients were asking was, you know, if the government shuts down, do I shut down? You know, that was the big question that folks had, and there was a whole, you know, set of legal principles around that, which, you know, focused mostly on, well, you know, has money been obligated to your contract, and if it has been, and yeah, you probably do need to continue to work. You know, that was the issue back at the time the question of the shutdown. You know, the question of the debt ceiling is a little different. It's not that the government is going to shut down, so it's not that our clients aren't asking, okay, well, you know, should I shut down? You know, the question with the debt ceiling is that the Treasury starts to run out of money. Who are they going to pay, and what priority are they going to get paid? And if the lack of money in the Treasury starts to impact payments to contractors, then what do they do? If they don't get paid in a timely manner, what are their remedies? And what do they do in that event? So that's really the focus with the question of the debt ceiling.
Right, and I guess so. It's one of these situations where we're sort of talking cash flow, and at some point, if it does work out that Congress and the President can reach some sort of agreement, then Treasury is going to have to prioritize. That's what I hear you saying, and that they're going to.
That's exactly right.
And I assume they're going to pay their creditors first, right? I would think.
I would hope. That is the safe money. I think that they are going to be paying the folks that we have obligations to first.
Right. You know, government contractors. Well, yeah, we'll get around to paying them whenever we can. So if I'm a government contractor in that situation, you know, what do I need to think about in terms of preparing for this potential situation?
Well, you need to, first of all, probably is to talk to your contracting officer and see what he or she is thinking about that question. See how much intelligence you can gather from the CO about how the agency is planning to handle a cash crunch. That would be my first recommendation. And then, you know, what can the contractor do for themselves? You know, just be thinking, again, as indicated before, you know, if the invoices are going in and they're not getting paid or they're getting paid slowly, start thinking about, you know, what kind of relief does the contractor want and what kind of relief is legally available if that happens.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can imagine for, you know, in particular, I'm thinking about now about small businesses who, you know, it's going to, just like everything that happens, you know, when these things happen or, you know, they change the rules, it has a bigger impact, it seems to me, on small businesses than anybody else. I mean, it could have a significant impact on whether a small business in particular can even perform a contract if all of a sudden, you know, they're payments are being, you know, slowed to a trickle or, you know, deferred for an uncertain amount of time. Do you have any advice for a small business in that situation?
I think that in that situation, the small business needs to be thinking, taking a careful look at their contract and determining whether the government would be in material breach if that happened. Because, you know, the question that comes up in this context is, if I don't get paid, you know, whether I'm a small contractor or a large contractor, you know, depending on the contract, if I'm not getting paid, is that a material breach? And if it is, then that would actually entitle the contractor to stop working. I think in a small business, when they're dependent upon the payments coming in, they need to carefully analyze their contracts with a lawyer and determine if there'd be some argument there that they could go ahead and stop working. You know, unfortunately, the general rule in government contracts is kind of regardless of what happens, you keep working, depending on the default clause that's in your contract. But that needs to be carefully assessed because, of course, if the small business or any business were to decide to stop work, later down the road, the government could say, well, we weren't in default, you were. So that would need to be very carefully assessed. But for a small business, you know, that's absolutely a very significant practical question that they'd have to, you know, think about very carefully.
What about, and I just, this is a crazy thought, and I know, you know, given what would happen if the debt ceiling wasn't raised, and who knows what would happen, but would contractors also, I mean, and I guess the full faith and credit of the United States, I don't, you know, if people are prioritized, I'm just wondering if a contractor could theoretically say, you know, it is still the United States government. I'm going to get paid at some point. Can I go to someone and, you know, get some additional financing to keep my operation going while I wait? You know, again, you know, people, you know, there's, you know, the whole assignments of claims and when companies are financed. And the, you know, and assign over the proceeds from a government contract to the financial institution, is that a possible avenue here, or is that is it too uncertain?
I think it's a possible avenue, but it's going to be completely a function of the credit markets. I'm not sure exactly right now how the credit markets would react. I tend to agree with you though that I think they would still see a U.S. government promise to pay is something that they're eventually going to get paid on, and so that they'd be willing to assume that risk to help some of these, especially smaller companies, stay afloat a little bit longer.
Yeah, but maybe at higher interest rates or something. Who knows?
That's
right?
Possible. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they'll adjust.
Yeah, the market.
Yeah, at least you're absolutely right. We'll be directly impacted by the market and what the, you know, I guess sort of outcome is with regard to picking priorities if the debt ceiling isn't raised and who gets paid and who doesn't. And, you know, just the whole perception, I guess, you know, that psychological human aspect. Well, you know what, Jason, right now, I think we've come up to the break. So, I mean, I want to keep talking about this. This is pretty interesting stuff. Again, it seems like we're back where we started, you know, back with all the continuing resolutions and the whole budget battle again, it seems to me, and it's going to potentially impact government contractors. But right now, we do have to take a break. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Are your business's online activities, networks, and information secure? Bolster your organization's cyber defenses by attending the Department of Homeland Security's G1st Conference in Nashville, August 7th through 12th. The nation's premier cybersecurity forum allows government and industry leaders to share cutting-edge cybersecurity solutions. G1st is free, so register today at uscert.gov. That's uscert.gov. Remember, cybersecurity is our shared responsibility.
Soon, this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. March for Babies! Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
Little of the sun's energy reaches any one particular spot, so solar energy panels need to take up a lot of space. That's why researchers are looking at nature for new ideas. Man-made solar cells are actually more efficient than plant cells at converting the sun's energy to useful forms, says Robert Blankenship, a Washington University in St. Louis professor. The problem is catching the rays. So Blankenship is studying light harvesting systems called chlorosomes in photosynthetic bacteria.
The system is simple in terms of the number of components that it has, yet it is very powerful in terms of light absorbing ability.
Chlorosomes are sort of like satellite dishes, but collect and funnel solar rays instead of TV signals.
The idea is not to put chlorosome complexes on everybody's roof, but rather to use the principles that we find out for how these things work to then design completely artificial systems.
More at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In an era of fiscal constraint marked by shrinking budgets and increasing demands on services, how are local government executives leveraging innovation, common sense, and technology to make a real difference? What is New York City doing to innovatively deliver health and human services? Join host Michael Keegan as he discusses New York City's efforts with Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services of the City of New York. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Attention all military, active duty, retired, and all authorized family members. Your Quantico Marine Corps Base Commissary is on the road and bringing your hard-earned commissary benefit directly to you. This on-site sale will take place at Fort AP Hill, August 18th and 19th. Come out and experience savings that average more than 30% on all your groceries. For more information, visit commissaries.com. And remember, your commissary, it's worth the trip.
Please join Jim Fleisig August 9th at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. This program will focus on cybersecurity, progress, and best practices within the federal government. The panel includes government leaders from USDA, FBI, and NIST. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum Tuesday, August 9th at 12 noon, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by McAfee HP Enterprise Services and Red Hat.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest for this segment is Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner in the law firm of McKenna Long and Aldrich and a expert in government contracts. Jason, you know, when we left, you were talking about sort of different remedies or issues that, you know, prime contractors face with regard to, you know, potential prioritizing of funding on part of the government and what they're going to pay or not pay if the debt ceiling isn't raised. You know, I guess that flows down, right? It flows down to subcontracts, subcontractors, and, you know, I guess from your perspective, what should subcontractors and even prime contractors thinking about their subcontracts be, you know, anticipating or thinking about doing with regard to the potential potentiality, I guess, that they may or may not get paid for a while?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with the contract. Both the prime and the sub need to pull out those subcontracts and take a look at how the payment clauses are worded. You know, a lot of subcontracts under government prime contracts are worded in such a way that the sub doesn't get paid until the prime gets paid. So if that's the way the subcontract is set up, at least from a legal perspective, you know, the prime doesn't have to worry about paying subs if there is a slowdown in payments to the prime, because the subs weren't going to get paid until the prime got paid anyway. And if the subcontract has that kind of clause in it, then the sub's kind of in the same boat as the prime is, just waiting for the government money to come along, and the sub is going to have to be negotiating with the prime, just as the prime is negotiating with the government CO. To try and work out something to stay afloat and keep everybody around that is needed to do the work, et cetera. Now, if the subcontract has a different kind of payment provision in it, where the sub is entitled to get paid regardless of whether the prime has gotten paid, you know, that's going to be a different calculus for the prime.
Right.
Right.
I mean, if they get paid on delivery of the product or service regardless,
right,
you know, then they're going to have to think about whether or not they – you know, I hate to use the word stop work order to their subcontractor or something. They may have to push back a little bit if they see that they're not going to be paid. Is that correct, do you think?
I think that's right. And so there's going to have to be, if they have a payment provision in the subcontract that's like that, that entitles the sub to get paid, when a deliverable is submitted or, you know, a monthly or whatever, and it's not dependent upon government payment, then the prime is going to have to carefully analyze what its rights are, just to issue a stop work or a partial termination or you know, however they want to deal with it. They're going to have to look and see what their contract rights are in the subcontracts.
Well, I hate to say this, but it sounds like a mess to me, Jason.
It is not the way this system is supposed to work, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, and then I could also say then it's tailor-made for lawyers, right?
That is unfortunately true. That is true.
Yeah. Well, in thinking about other remedies, can you tell me a little bit about, there is a thing called the Prompt Payment Act as well with regard to government contracts. What is that, and what would it mean for a government contractor who's facing the situation of a delayed payment due to the debt ceiling?
Sure. I mean, the Prompt Payment Act is exactly, you know, what the name suggests, is that the government is obligated to pay its bills within a certain, you know, the contractor's invoices within a 30-day time period. If the government misses that deadline, then interest begins to accrue. Now, that it's not a high rate of interest. It's 2.5% per annum. But it is something. So that would be the prime's remedy. And then, you know, as we were talking about with subcontractors, that would be a function, again, of the particular subcontract. Now, if the subcontract had flowed down the Prompt Payment Act provision, then the sub would just be in the same position as the prime. But there'd have to be the subcontract would have to be consulted to see, you know, what remedy the sub had for late payment.
Okay, so 2.5%?
2.5%.
2.5%. Yeah, okay. All right. Well, that's better than nothing, right?
Better than nothing.
Right. Okay. Well, it's better than going to the bank right now, right? And getting the interest rate on your on your savings account or whatever. Right?
Yeah. That's true.
Well, hey, so what I'm hearing here, just to sort of go back real quick again, is like you need if you're a government contractor, you're prime, or even if you're sub, you got to survey all your contracts, see what's going on, so you're not just talking to, when you say talk to the contracting officer, you got to talk across your portfolio of government contracts to try to figure out where the gaps are going to fall, or if in fact they do fall, right?
That's exactly right.
And that just goes back to this issue that I find it's really interesting. As a former government employee, I worked for a reimbursable organization, so we were funded via fees that we charge other agencies. That's the General Services Administration, but there are going to be appropriations that have already been put in place and money, in the coffer, so to speak, and I guess that can't be sort of moved to other priorities, or how does that work, or am I missing something there?
Well, when there's money that's already been obligated, appropriated and obligated, the money that's sitting there is appropriated. There's certain things I think that the Treasury can do to move money around. But once if money has been appropriated or something, that's where it sits. Which raises the possibility that the government's going to remain open. If the debt ceiling is not raised, that isn't going to result in a shutdown. So government contracting will go on. So money that's sitting there and is appropriated, they'll continue to be able to issue contracts. For folks chasing new work, there's still going to be new work out there, but they're going to have to contractors going to have to think very long and hard about in pursuing this new work. They're going to get it, and then when are they going to get paid? The mere fact of hitting the debt ceiling isn't going to stop contracting from going, continuing to happen.
Well, this is a pretty fascinating area, I must say, and I find it really interesting that, I've never seen anything quite like it, Jason. Like, between all the continuing resolutions, the final budget and potential shutdown, now we have the debt ceiling and we're approaching the end of the fiscal year. I've never seen anything quite like it in terms of the challenge that in the procurement environment in terms of the cash flow and this sort of thing. Have you ever seen anything quite like this?
It's easy to say, but...
But still,
it's easy to say, but it kind of is a confluence of just kind of a perfect storm of a financial mess, and it's looking at it from our perspective of the impact on the procurement community, that's not an issue that gets a lot of attention, but when you think of the extent to which the government is reliant upon contractors. And I do think, I'm not sure how much government agencies, have been thinking this through of what the impact of this is going to be for their contractors. Because, kind of as you were, indicating, Roger, when the government folks are, they get appropriated money to their agencies and they get paid, and they're not thinking about, where does my contractor fall in that scenario?
Right.
It could have a significant impact on the government accomplishing its mission if contractors aren't getting paid.
Well, on that happy note, Jason. We have to close the show, so I want to thank Jason Workmaster, partner of McKenna, Long & Aldridge, for joining me today. I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.